And it's a discussion led by the past recipients of the Harvey Miller Award. The moderator is Jack Butler, everyone knows, Executive Vice President of Hilco, one of the most well-known and highly regarded deal makers and thought leaders in the restructuring and corporate reorganization and M&A community. So please join me in welcoming Jack and his distinguished panel.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Obviously, we just spent 45 minutes hearing Ken and Jim talk a little bit, but we're going to drill back down over some slightly different questions. Our apologies, Steve Cooper called in sick this morning and is not able to join us, but we also do have as another past Harvey winner, David Resnick here from Third Avenue. So we wanted to start this program with something. This is something that Peter and Nina and I thought would be appropriate. This is the first year, obviously, that the Harvey is being given out without Harvey. And so we reached out to some of the past recipients, and current recipients, all three Harvey winners up here, and talked with people about the idea that it might be sense to sort of kick off the afternoon session with having some of the Harvey winners here to talk about what's going on in the restructuring. We'll give you kind of their perspective on some things. But we also thought we'd start out on a personal note and ask each of them to, and we'll each talk a little bit about perhaps an anecdote or remembrance about the good, the bad, and the ugly of our friend Harvey Miller. So Jim, I'm going to start with you, but just ask you to sort of start out with a story.
So, you know, as you know, I grew up with Harvey. My father and he were partners, so he was really part of my life since I was, I don't know, 13 or 12, something like that. And the first big case that I worked on across the table from Harvey, he went out of his way to show no special favors or treatment to me. I represented a creditor. He was, as usual, representing a debtor. But at some point, I found myself, I was a young lawyer, and my investment banking client, a young David Schulte, who was the banker for the creditors that I was working for, kind of pushed me up front to give a speech on equitable subordination. And Harvey, you could see, Harvey was just completely mystified. And it wasn't clear that I really knew what the hell I was talking about. And he went like this across the table, room filled with 50 people. He went like this. And I went like this. And he went like this. And I said, okay. And he took me outside and said, Jim, do me a favor. Don't talk about equitable subordination unless you know what the fuck you're talking about. And so I learned a very important lesson that you can bluff some people some of the time, but Harvey on the law, never.
So I have three short memories of Harvey that relate to my career and special relationship I was able to develop with him. And, you know, similar to Jim, it was the first two relate to substance. And one was as a young investment banker. I had come across Harvey earlier in my career, but generally we were on opposite sides of the table. So I had a sense of him and his personality. And when we first worked together on a debtor assignment, it was for a company called Edison Brothers Stores. And I was leading the engagement on the banking side, and Harvey was company counsel, and we were having to go through valuation issues, and I was going to be testifying, and that was something that, you know, Harvey was always very skeptical of how investment bankers did valuation. I think he just felt they just kind of put their finger up in the air and came up with the number. That was until he took his brief detour to an investment bank. But at the time,
then
he was always
even more skeptical.
He was very skeptical. But and I went through my fairly methodical presentation, and Harvey also was fairly relentless in jumping in and testing and pushing. But what what I really learned was not just from the skepticism, but a sense of really being prepared in this business when you testify. It's very important to understand how people are going to come at you from all different perspectives, some from detailed knowledge and some from just because they want to come at you, and you have to be prepared for all elements. And I think working with Harvey, you learn that, and it certainly made me a better banker in the many times I've had to testify. After that time on Edison Brothers, I think I became much more effective as a result of that. And the second point was around giving advice to clients. Harvey was someone who was always very direct in a small room with the client one-on-one. And it's very hard sometimes when you're trying to develop a relationship, have someone trust you and work with you, to be able to have that balance of giving very objective advice that you know someone doesn't hear. And many times people just don't do that because it's easier not to. And that was never the case with Harvey. If he believed in something and thought it was right, he was going to let the client know. And working with him in those situations, again, allowed me to understand what I think is very valuable about being an advisor in the restructuring business, which is being completely objective and giving that advice to your clients. And then the third point was more personal. As I got to know him, many people appreciate that one of Harvey's big interests was the opera. And I had the chance, my wife and I, to go to the opera with him and Ruth many times. And he was incredibly knowledgeable about the opera, as he was about restructuring. And having discussions with him on that was just something that I won't forget. Gave you a sense of a different dimension of him.
So I unfortunately didn't go to law school, so I didn't really know Harvey as well as everyone else on this panel, but I did work with him briefly on General Growth Properties, where while Gottschall was company counsel, we were the company's investment banker, and during the depths of the financial crisis, we had a very challenging problem, which was the company owned all of its malls through bankruptcy remote subsidiaries. And the only way we could save the company was to bankrupt the bankruptcy remote subsidiaries, but of course they're bankruptcy remote. So we sat down with Harvey and his team and we explained how we would proceed to go about bankrupting these things. And I think most people were totally shocked and skeptical this could be done. And thank God Harvey said, well, it's crazy, but it's crazy enough that it'll work. And once he told the board that our theory, as outlandish as it was, had a pretty good chance of working, we went ahead and did it exactly that way. And it wasn't for Harvey's guidance of the board doing something that, frankly, the board really didn't think could get done. And it was somewhat risky. It wouldn't have been able to save the company. And I think he was remarkable because he was, a man of great courage, which is something most people don't appreciate about him, that he always wanted to do what he felt was the right thing, no matter what the consequences were, and even if it was unpopular. And I think his career always demonstrated that quality, which I think is something that we should all remember and try to emulate as much as we can.
I think one of the things that elements of Harvey's legacy is the number of people who sit around talking and have a Harvey anecdote or a Harvey story and feel that they had a special relationship with Harvey. The Opera House was full of those people at the memorial service for him. But I think we all know Harvey, before we deify him too much, he was a very complex guy, brilliant and complex. And he didn't have a huge amount of time or appetite for those people he viewed to be his adversaries. And if you're a lawyer, as I was at the time, and representing other parties, you typically were on the other side of the table. And so what I found sort of remarkable about Harvey was the level of the complexity and how much he not only cared about positions and people and fought passionately about things, but his ability to actually reach out and deal with you in ways that were completely unanticipated. So I got to know Harvey probably best as he was leaving Weill, on a personal level, as he was leaving Weill and going to Greenhill. And there were moments there during that transition when, and I won't repeat the conversations, but had a series of conversations about Harvey, about his view of transitions and timing and law firms and banking and what he was doing and why he was doing it and his thoughts on the issues, which were, I think, had the sort of the full bouquet of emotions from logic to other emotions as he went through it. But I got to know him better then than I probably knew him in the decades prior to that time. And then, you know, who knew that he would come back to the law from there and only do the biggest, you know, cases of his career, perhaps, but certainly some of the huge things. And there, I learned some things from him. One of the things that people don't really know, which is sort of interesting, was in the automotive restructuring business when he was first a banker and then a lawyer, at working with General Motors. There was a time prior to all the, you know, in the mid, whatever that was at the time, 2005, the mid part of that decade, where some of the parts suppliers were having significant difficulties, and Delphi, which was the largest supplier in the world, was having significant difficulties. I ended up being Delphi's principal outside restructuring counsel, working with Steve Miller. What most people don't know is that one of the people who was instrumental in recommending that happen to Steve and convincing Steve that should happen was Harvey, who had in fact represented Steve during the Bethlehem Steel years, and with whom I had more than a few arguments, both as a banker and a lawyer, during the Delphi days, as Al knows, and David and others who are around here. I also spent a bunch of time with Harvey in the American Airlines case. I'll only leave you with two anecdotes. Most of you who know me know that, you know, I like microphones and talking and like to have the last word. One of the things you learn as a lesson with Harvey is you never try to have the last word with Harvey, right? And even I learned that lesson.
But did it take?
It took forever, but I remember, much to the amazement of many of the people in this room, in one of the early on American Airlines court hearings, which had hundreds of people at it and the media were at it, we'd filed some papers explaining how the creditors committee, who Jake Offman and I were representing, along with our colleagues, and Al and others, how we were going to handle the case, and that we had a point of view that was a little different. Now, ultimately, that led to a merger that was, you know, it led to something. We knew kind of a direction it was going. I'm not sure it was all clear at that point in time, but we sort of laid out a kind of a manifesto of how we thought things ought to go forward. Harvey did not like that piece of paper when it was filed. And in this court hearing, Harvey gets up in front, and at the end of the hearing, there's nothing contested about this. We're not having an argument. But Harvey comes and gets up and tells the world and the judge and a few other people what he kind of thought of me and of this statement and of the direction that was going on in no uncertain terms. And I actually sat in the seat, took it, did not get up, and much to everyone's amazement, did not get up and say anything. Because, in fact, there was nothing to be said. And ultimately, you don't necessarily, one of the things you learned with Harvey early on is getting into a verbal battle with Harvey over just words, probably not the smartest thing you can do, no matter what your motivation might be. So I think all of us, you know, remember Harvey as the complex guy he was, brilliant, remarkable, emotional, passionate, and someone whom I think we're delighted to see that, Ken, you got the Harvey this year, then we're glad to know there'll be a Harvey next year, and that his memory will continue to be honored, Nina and Peter, at this conference. So with that, let's go through kind of a lightning round over the next 30 minutes, because we're going to be done on time and give the panel over to other people. What I really wanted to do is ask a series of questions of this group. And actually, I'm going to start with a sector question. And Jim, you were in the news last week. You're in the news a lot. You were in the news with Puerto Rico. You were in the news with other activities. But you were in the news last week because you partnered with an energy investment bank to advise oil and gas companies who are suffering from depressed commodity prices. You've joined up with people. David, your former firm, it's in the news, has joined forces with another oil investment bank down in Texas to do kind of the same thing, to win energy assignments. Lots of things going on in that industry. Assets are being sold, debts being reduced, people are trying to raise additional capital, lots of opportunity. I guess my question to all of you, but I'm going to start, Jim, with you, is this the go-to sector for 2016? And in addition to that sector, what are your other two sectors you'd say are the go-to sectors for next year?
Yeah, I think oil and gas, and it's the ancillary industries around it. You know, suppliers to that industry, you know, transportation companies that are primarily focused on that industry, who carry its goods. I think they're that it's this is a big swoon in commodity prices that's going to drive lots of restructuring activity in a sector that's had a significant overinvestment. I think the other, you know, the other big, I don't know, I don't, you know, see anybody, I'm not going to talk about imminent defaults, but I mean, obviously the government sector, you know, there are governments all over the world and across municipal and state governments across the United States that are laboring under a set of fiscal policies they really can't sustain. And so there's going to be, even if it doesn't have defaults around it, there are going to be significant restructurings of the way governments operate.
I'd agree with Jim on the energy sector being probably the most active area for restructuring in 2016. What I think's interesting is that many companies were able to survive in 2015 because of hedges that they had put on. Some continue into 2016, but at some point they really need to assess their ability to operate with the cost structure they have in place, the prices that are in place, and determine whether or not the business remains viable. And I think that's going to prompt additional consolidation. There'll probably be more M&A, there'll be more restructuring, but I think there's going to be an overall assessment on the part of investors. And now that I've changed my hat from investment banking to the investing world, it's an area that we've taken a very detailed look at, is what really are the right asset values for energy companies today. And I think that's true with many of the mid-sized companies that are more likely to restructure, but it's also going to be true with some of the larger companies that on the surface are financially healthy, but they are valuing their reserves at certain prices. And if you have a point of view that oil is going to remain at a lower price for a longer period of time, what happens to those capital projects that they had begun offshore in difficult places where if oil is not $70 a barrel, $60 a barrel, it's going to be hard to have those projects viable. So I think there's going to be a broader reassessment of the assets that support many of these companies. The other area that I think is going to be interesting, and Ken and Jim talked about it at lunch, and I find it one of the most fascinating parts of the evolution of the restructuring business, and that's what's going to happen with pensions and a lot of the municipalities. Just look state after state, and everyone's trying to sort out how to handle the restructuring. I mean, you have an example of what worked in Detroit. You have several other cases that haven't worked. You have a situation that looks like it has a very challenging solution going on in Puerto Rico. But people are going to have to figure out a way to address some of these issues because the, you know, long-term viability of many of these pension obligations are not sustainable. It happened in the corporate sector. Many of us participated in that several years ago, but I think it's just starting in the municipal sector.
I agree with David and Jim in terms of energy. I think I would just add two things. First, what's gotten much less attention, which I find a little strange, is the mining sector. And that's probably because there are relatively few mining companies left in the United States. Most of it's global. But of any sector that is overinvested in capacity, that sector takes the cake. People basically spend billions of dollars to develop mining projects globally, which cannot possibly make money at today's commodity prices, and yet they're stuck because they've got so much money invested in them, they have no choice but to continue either to operate them and eke out a little bit of cash flow, or keep developing them because they can't afford the write-off. And that's actually a very interesting sector to pay attention to internationally. Secondly, coming back to the United States for a minute, one of the sectors that I think is going to be shocking to people in how it falls apart are the MLPs. You know, MLPs, of course, were a big craze in the markets the last couple of years. Everybody wanted big dividends. But MLPs are financially and fundamentally unstable because they cannot retain earnings. And they're built on the presumption, especially the pipeline MLPs, that they will make more money by increasing volumes and building more pipelines to carry oil and gas to market. But they're just a service sector like every other service sector, and they have no financial flexibility to withstand either no growth in demand for what they do or declining growth. And that is going to shock a lot of people over the next few years, especially if this depression in price persists. And then, interestingly enough, I'm not sure whether they thought about it at the time, but you, some of you may be aware that Kinder Morgan, which is the largest pipeline operator in the United States, converted from being an MLP to a C corporation a few years ago. Now, they claim they did it to simplify their lives. I don't think they necessarily saw this coming, but in hindsight, what a brilliant move that was, because now they can raise equity in the market and withstand the decline in price better than their peers. So I think that in addition to the service companies running into trouble, that sector is financially going to be, I think, a serious problem for a lot of people who were not expecting it.
So by show of hands, anybody predict a national big box retailer bankruptcy in 2016? You do raise your hand. Anybody?
You do?
No, I'm asking you.
Which
one? Any big box retailer in 2016 in the U.S.?
You know, there's a certain company that people have been calling dead for many Christmas seasons, but they seem to have nine lives.
Right. I mean, I think the interesting story in retail is there was a lot of retail activity there this year, but it was mostly small box retailers.
Right.
Very few, and that's why I asked the question: big box retailer versus small box retailer. There are a lot of number of national small box retailers that either restructured or went out of business. No view there. Well, let's go back to
how David. Many people think a major retailer can restructure today?
Well, that's another question, whether it just liquidates or not. But right. I was just asking about
only
whether or not
they own real estate.
I think that's a real, I think that's a real question, as we've talked about in the past. Let's talk then. Go back, David, to what you said about pension funds. You were talking usually about pension funds. What's going on? Pension funds are interestingly acting a lot like other investors in a world where they're artificially suppressed yields. They're shifting to riskier assets. And pension fund after pension fund are concluding it's a necessity because their assumptions about investment rates dictate the discount rate used to calculate the present value of their liabilities. And so as soon as you admit you can't make 8% when risk-free assets are yielding less than 2%, in the U.S. and close to zero in other locales, you're actually more underfunded than you were advertising. So the solution is to take risks and move forward in that. And I guess the question I have is, from your view, as pension funds continually increase their risks, I saw one report that said that the percentage of their capital dedicated to equities had risen from under 30% two decades ago to as high as 60% today. So doubling the concentration in equities. How do you think this phenomena with pension funds is going to carry itself out in 2016? And how's that trend going to affect distressed investors? Start with you, David.
Well, just as an example, to your point about the 8% hurdle, I'm on the board of two not-for-profits and sit on the investment committee, and we look at how much of our endowment do we want to use, and you know, rule of thumb is typically, you know, 4 to 5%. You look at, you know, what you're earning, and some people, if they've had a good track record, it's a little higher. But I would say everyone now is bringing down that hurdle rate. You have to, particularly if you want to have a balanced portfolio. So a pension fund keeping that rate at 8%, I think that's going to be tough if this interest rate environment continues. And I'm more interested in the municipal side, because I think there, the tools that you have to use are more challenging, because you're either going to have to increase taxes and make greater contributions, or you're going to have to get people to negotiate lower benefits or change to the benefits. And the formula of just kind of pushing this out and assuming an investment return isn't happening. So I'm very curious about what the answer is going to be, because I think it's finally coming together because of the bankruptcies that we've had with the municipalities, and there's going to have to be some other resolution because the amount of the unfunded is going to get too high. The right solution, it's probably would never happen, is a legislative one where you have to keep pensions at a certain percentage of a funded amount. But I don't know any legislature that's probably going to want to do that because of the implications that that would drive. But I think that would be the right answer.
Ken?
Well, I've given this question a lot of thought. We had to deal with it in Detroit, and we're trying to deal with it now in other places. I think fundamentally the debate about the unfunded liability, it's the wrong question to be asking, because what really crushes state budgets and city budgets is not the absolute amount, but the annual cost of servicing the pension obligation, which is set actuarially and is a variable number, which makes it really hard to plan a services budget. And I think ultimately what's going to have to happen economically is a conversion of those unfunded variable pension contribution costs to more fixed contributions, either through creating debt that is contributed to the plans in exchange for certainty, or a capping of the amount that can be spent. Because mathematically, if you look across any of the S&P or Moody's studies of municipal finance, you'll see that one of the fascinating implications of municipal issuers that are rated single A or better is that in no case is a total percentage of unfunded pension costs, OPEB costs, and debt costs more than 20% of the annual budget. And even that's a high number. 15% is more typical. So you know pretty much that if you're spending more than that, you're on the wrong side of the curve. You're going to be Detroit if you don't get your act together. And that's why eventually there's going to have to be probably state legislation enacted that prevents cities from spending more than that percentage on such costs. Now, you're all aware that right now in most states there's a state limitation on the amount of funded debt that can be issued relative to the appraised value of real estate, right? That's pretty universal. But it doesn't extend to promises made to employees. And that has not been captured yet by any state legislature. To David's point, that's eventually going to have to get enacted because you can't separate one kind of debt promise from another.
Right. But you all are focusing to a certain extent, I get why, on the user side, if you will, of the pension problem, which is the relationship between the pension funds and the pension agreements and those who have the obligations. Mm-hmm. What, Jim, I'd like you sort of, your perspective on, if you will, is kind of the other side of the equation, which is the fact that people who are investing the funds that are actually there, trying to actually increase that corpus, are finding themselves acting, you know, whether they like it or not, you know, assuming much more risky profiles and changing the balance of what they're investing in, such that we could wake up one day, right, and find out that pension funds, which are supposed to be somewhat conservatively invested, and in fact, have taken major hits. You've seen some of in the headlines even in the last week, some major pension funds in this country have reported very significant losses.
Yeah, so I mean, look, the fiduciary rules around ERISA-governed plans are pretty good at keeping pension trustees from, you know, going too far out on a limb. I think the low interest rate environment obviously puts these guys under real pressure, and you know, they have been a source of really the growth in non-traditional asset managers. Both on the private equity and hedge fund side, as they've sought to goose returns. You know, I think that's probably going to slow down, both because of the increasing pressure and focus on the fees that public pension plans are paying to, you know, masters of the universe here in this fair city and other cities where institutional funds are managed. So I think what David said is probably the right answer for the funds, which is people are going to have to lower the hurdle rates to what are more realistic so you can have a balanced portfolio, and that's going to put more pressure on state and local and corporate corporations to fund these plans. The minimum funding contribution will go up as the hurdle rates come down in order to keep the plan solvent. So, you know, this is ultimately the adjusting returns and discount rates to a low interest rate environment, a prolonged period of low interest rates, is going to be one that's going to put even greater pressure on municipal budgets and state budgets and corporate budgets to fund these plans at greater rates than they're currently being funded.
I mean, it's important to remember that the fundamental laws of economics apply here. I mean, when you have economic growth rates of 2% or lower, and you have no growth in productivity, you cannot have a return on capital that's much greater than 5 or 6%. You just can't do it, and that's even including the minimal effects of inflation. So the problem is that these policies are all set in a different environment than the one we're in, and people have not adjusted yet. The only way you can get back to those rates of return is to have higher economic growth, call it 3 or 4%, which is not likely, or a vast increase in productivity, which is also not likely.
So let's talk a little bit about the Fed then. And about interest rates. I mean, the Federal Reserve is about to become counter to all the other central banks in the world, just about, who are tend to be reducing, you know, increasing quantitative easing and increasing support. The Fed is about to raise rates in a couple of weeks, and if not a couple of weeks, in a couple of months, but maybe in a couple of weeks. And I guess the question I would ask you about the rates is, you know, does it matter? And when I say does it matter, I don't mean it just pejoratively. I mean, you know, some people would argue that the only way we're ever going to get out of the current place we're in is for rates to go up, inflation to go up. The Fed not only has to monetary policy, it's got to get a bunch of assets off its balance sheet at some point, right? And it's not going to get those, and a lot of people don't believe it'll get that stuff off its balance sheet unless, in fact, values get inflated to get it off the balance sheet. So when you're sitting there as a Fed governor, Mr. Buckfire, right? What are you going to, you know, how are you going to vote and why? Where are you taking monetary policy?
Well, it's a really fascinating problem that the Federal Reserve has created for itself because, well, I'm trying to be polite. It's hard. You know, on the one hand, zero interest rates have been the only thing that propped up the economy to date, but that has created a huge dilemma because, as we all know, one of the two most important drivers of economic growth are consumption spending and exports. Well, when you have a dollar which has been relatively weak, our export sector has done really, really well. But that is now reversed. And now we're in a world of competitive devaluation. One of the reasons that the ECB and probably the JNB are not going to raise rates is because they want their currencies to decline relative to the dollar, which has already happened, and it'll be more so, which means that our companies are simply not going to export enough, which means that we're setting up for a recession, not because of rates policy, but because of currency issues. And the Fed is very much aware of this. But they also recognize that the longer they keep suppressing rates, the more systemic imbalances they create in the United States. So no matter where they turn, they're now faced with choosing the least worst option. And therefore, not because of interest rates, but because of the impact on the export sector, you can expect there to be more of a recessionary impact of raising rates for no other reason than our export sector is going to become much less competitive. Some of you may have noticed recently that the press has picked up on the fact that the euro is likely to go to parity against the dollar in the next 6 months based on our rates policy. Well, that's great for the Europeans, but it's not good for us. And that's going to have a very negative impact in the United States.
So how are you voting, Governor Buckfire?
I vote to raise rates because, again, it's a least worst choice. The longer you maintain rates at these levels, the more systemic imbalances you build and more risk you build up in the economy. So
Governor,
you might as well prick it
how
now.
How are you voting?
I think a quarter basis point increase in rates, which is what they're talking about, is not going to have a dramatic impact on the economy. I think it's already been built in to the market. The bigger issue is what happens as Europe and the U.S. and China, to some extent, head off in their different directions. What worries me is, you know, we do have greater activity here in the U.S., so you can defend a slight increase in rates. But at some point, the world is much more interdependent. So if we don't have policies that have some alignment in terms of the approach, we're never going to get that liftoff that we need in the global economy, and that's what's going to be what changes the whole situation that we're in of just slower or little growth. And as we drift further apart in terms of how the central banks approach these issues, the challenges only increase.
Jim, the IMF just voted this morning to add China's currency to the reserve currencies of the world. As we move on with this, how are you voting on rates, and where do you think they're going to go? And is there going to be this increasing disparity between the U.S. and everyone else?
I actually think that's what the IMF bringing the renminbi into the reserve currencies of the world is a much bigger event than whether the Fed raises rates 25 basis points or even 100 basis points over the next year. The British pound sterling was the reserve currency of choice headed into the 1920s. And but as a result of World War I and just the complete destruction the Europeans did to their own economies during that period, the United States became a supplier, a trade supplier of choice. And with the United States, the growth in the export sector in the United States of everything from steel to basic commodities, the dollar became increasingly used in international transactions. And by the end of the 20s, heading into the Great Depression, the dollar was the reserve currency. The pound sterling had lost its status as the premier reserve currency. And with it, the British economy went into basically a 50-year recession. We are grossly underprepared for the accession of the Chinese and the renminbi to becoming the world's reserve currency, but it is happening much quicker than we appreciate. The IMF is just the IMF action this morning just is validation of the fact that more trade flows are being denominated in renminbi, and there need to be offshore pools of renminbi in order to actually process financial and trade transactions. So this, to me, is a much bigger issue for the future of the U.S. economy than anything else out there, whether the Fed raises or not. The other thing I would say about the Fed is people lose sight of that. They think this is, you know, some sophisticated exercise in monetary policy and balancing the, you know, the risk-free rate of return. They're the central bank of the United States. We have had a completely bankrupt fiscal policy for the last 8 years. The Congress of the United States has been totally missing in action in terms of addressing the economic imbalances in the country. And the Fed was really left but no choice to be the firefighter and the stimulus provider to a completely broken Congress. There are the federal government's finances as a result of basically a stalemate on the Hill. The federal government's finances are actually in better shape than they have been in 8 years. And as a result, the Fed actually has some room to increase rates, subject to what Ken was talking about over lunch, which is, at the end of the day, they're managing interest rate policy for the federal government. If we were borrowing as a federal government at the average rate that the federal government borrowed at over the last 30 years, which is 7%, the interest cost on the federal budget would triple. And instead of being 7 or 8% of total federal spending, it would be in the 20s, which would be what the IMF thinks as unsustainable. It's in the red zone for fiscal and debt sustainability. So the Fed, at the end of the day, is really managing that problem, that the federal government really cannot afford to devote a huge chunk of its budget to debt service that it would if we actually normalize rates to the average interest rate that's prevailed in the United States since the end of the Second World War. So, you know, I would say China is something everybody's got to watch. The renminbi becoming a reserve currency, that is going to grow much faster. And the internationalization of the renminbi is really, really important. But the Fed's raising interest rate, this is really most about debt management of the federal budget.
Well, I wanted to talk about the $4 trillion Chinese bond market and some things we want to talk about that's going on there, some interesting stuff. But we are at our time's end. So I want to thank all of you very much and thank all of you for letting us reminisce a little bit about Harvey Miller today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good to see you guys. That was fun.